Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 21st day of August. Very nice to have you on this Thursday morning, 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. And just listening to the music of Vinta, fine, fine music makers, and a damn fine paper towel. Good morning, all. Welcome. It's very nice. I was out yesterday. I'm back today. I took a day off yesterday. Went on a road trip. There's a guy by the name of Chris Bohjalian, who is an Oprah pick author, a best-selling author. He has scores of number one New York Times bestsellers to his credit. He lives in Middlebury, Vermont. He wrote a book called The Princess of Las Vegas. And in that book, which came out in paperback earlier this year, in that book, he mentions this really cool thing that happened. It's true. There was an Elvis impersonator in Las Vegas, and the Elvis impersonator befriended this guy, and they became business partners. And the guy who was the friend did a lot of the work on the shows in Las Vegas, a lot of the sets and so forth. But he was best known for the guy who created the sets for Star Trek. So when he passed, this guy in Ticonderoga, New York, James Cawley, got the plans, and he built an exact replica of the Star Trek sets in an old supermarket in Ticonderoga. It's been there for years. We've reported it about here. Lucas Willard did an amazing story several years ago. Really good stuff. I had never been there. And I was talking to Chris about it during an interview that I did with him on stage, I believe in Saratoga, although it could have been in Vermont. I don't remember. And Chris says, well, how about we go? And I said, all right. And so out of the blue, Chris calls me and said, let's go on a road trip. I go, okay, let's go on a road trip. So we went up yesterday. We put on our Star Trek gear, which we didn't have. We had to buy. We didn't. So like, I just want to give you the level of geekdom. Like, there. And we went in, and we had this amazing tour, and we got beamed up, and we just had an absolute blast playing on the sets of Star Trek yesterday. If you're ever up that way and you get a chance, it's really an amazing thing to see, especially if you're a Star Trek fan.
It is so bizarre that you are the second person that I've spoken to this week who went to Ticonderoga.
Oh, really? Oh, that's
for Star Trek. That's hilarious.
Oh, that's really.
I'm glad you had a
really
good time.
Cool. Oh, it was so much fun. It was just, and Chris is a hoot. I love Chris is just the real deal. He's just an amazing guy. So smart, so funny. We told he and I were telling really good stories about books and publishing and authors, and it was just a delightful day. Chris is how do I put this, more actor sized than I am, and so he was just like running around those sets and going up in them. In the little pipes and holes, and it's good for him, you know.
Skittering around.
Exactly. And I was just like, oh, I'll just sit in the chair. But it was fun. I have some pictures up on Facebook and Instagram, it was a very, very fun day. But it's good to be back. We've got a lot to talk about. We have a great group to do it with. Let me introduce them to you right now. The mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan, is in the house. Good morning, Mayor. How are you?
I am good. How are you?
I'm well. It's really nice to have you back. Thank you so much for doing it. I hope you know how much we appreciate you being here. It's wonderful. I know you've got a city to run, but I'm very glad you could take a few moments out and be with us. Grants analyst Emily Honan is here. I haven't seen you in a long time. I don't know. You've been on the show, and I just haven't been here. But it's nice to have you back.
Yeah, July and June and July are the really busy grant season for New York. So I took a little break from the radio to attend to my duties.
Well, to actually do your job?
Yeah.
The one that pays, right. It's a delight to have you back. Thank you very much.
Thank
we
you.
Always love when you're here. Terry Gibson joins us, preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at a place called Harvard University. Hello, Terry Gibson. How are you?
I'm great, Joe. Good morning. Thanks for having me. And thanks for that intro about Star Trek. It was nice to start the day off with something besides Donald Trump.
Well, you know, you make a good point, because this was something that both Chris and I were talking about as we were leaving yesterday. We said it was nice to spend the day in 1969, and 1969 wasn't that great of a year either, but it just did seem better by comparison. So
definitely
very, very, very nice to have you here, and I thank you very much for taking the time out, as always. All right, let's start and talk about what is going on in this big old world of ours. And we'll start with Texas gerrymandering and sort of a two-part story. We can take this separately, but I'll give you both headlines, and we can start with Texas. Texas Republicans are poised to pass the new redistricting map. So remember, all the Democrats left the state for a long time to try to put off this vote for as long as possible. And now they're back, and the state Senate will vote Thursday on maps, that's today, to help the GOP with 5 more U.S. House seats in the midterm elections. California Democrats will counter on the same day, and we'll talk a little bit about California in a few moments. The Texas House passed an aggressively partisan congressional map on Wednesday after weeks of legislative combat, giving President Trump and the gerrymander he requested and possibly 5 new Republican seats in the U.S. House next year. After more than 8 hours of at times tense and emotional debate, the final vote, 88-52, fell squarely along party lines. It capped bitterly partisan political wrangling with a Democratic walkout and Republican retaliation, and set off a redistricting fever that has spread from Austin to Sacramento to right here in Albany, New York. Terry, I'll let you start off on this.
Well, the battle has begun. I think you're going to see every state in the country debate whether there's a way to do this or not, regardless of what party currently holds the majority. And I think that there's no way out of it at this point. We're in a situation where our democracy is really very much at stake. And those who want to fight for freedom and justice have really no choice at this point but to try to get as many members of the Democratic Party elected as possible in Congress, so that we have some power again, so that we can begin to put some checks and balances on a system right now which has very little. I know that there will be many on both sides of this issue that will debate whether it's right or wrong, and I think those are all valid arguments. One of the things that I find interesting is that the Democratic Party, for the most part, in various states, has dealt with redistricting in a way where it has essentially been turned over to the voters. A referendum of some sort from the voters is often needed to finalize the redistricting in terms of how Democrats have set it up in the past. But when Republicans have had control of the redistricting process, they have often set it up where voters don't necessarily have a say-so in it, and that's what's going on in Texas. So it's interesting how the Democratic Party has tried to be the party of the people, and here we are now in a situation where it's going to be a little bit harder for Democrats to get the redistricting done. It's a little bit easier for Republicans to do it in places where the voters don't have a say-so in it, like Texas. But still, I think that we haven't even begun to see the end of this. It's just beginning. I think you will see districts change in multiple states, both red and blue, and it's going to be close. It's going to be a close election, as we always knew it would be.
Mayor.
Well, you know, I think that given the court rulings on this, it's interesting that Texas is being so blatantly partisan about it. And I think that's to deflect from the impact of this redistricting on race. And it sounds like the Democrats are going to sue over the maps based on that. But they have said over and over again, we redo these so that we could have more Republican districts. And so they're very straightforward about what they're doing. And again, this is as a result of the Supreme Court decision that said you can be political about how you create these districts. You just can't be racist about it. And so they have gone at this very openly and directly. And I don't know that any challenge of these maps will be successful or even that it will play out before the midterm elections next year.
Emily?
Yeah, and I think that the timing is something that I've thought a lot about. I mean, I've talked about this before, but Democrats keep trying to go about this in, you know, the dutiful way, the lawful way. You know, we have the voter referendums and everything, and we're dealing with people who are either not playing by the rules or they're just making up new rules to suit them. And it's very easy for, you know, the Texas Republicans to do this because they know that they have the support of a in executive branch that's steadily growing in power, where at this point I'm not sure if anything can combat it. And they know that they're allowed to do whatever they want, and they're going to do it, and they're going to be blatant about it. And it's going to be, even though it's very true that it's racist, it's going to be difficult to prove that, and it's definitely not going to happen on a time frame that's feasible.
I was struck, Terry, by something you said about both sides, you know, argue over this. I mean, I think there does seem to be somewhat of a consensus that there are members of both parties that say that this isn't the way it should be done, but this is the way that they're going to have to do it to, quote, fight fire with fire. But it does seem, and I know this is probably a naive statement, but it does seem like we can come up with a fair system that actually cannot be manipulated as easy as it seems that it's being manipulated now.
I'm not so sure about that. having spent time myself in a state legislature that redrew the maps when I was there, I'm just not sure about that. I think ultimately, when you turn a system over to politicians to make the decisions, there's always going to be a few in that group. They're going to find a way to manipulate it. And it's just the nature of how the game is played, regardless of what party you're in. And because so much power is at stake and so many important decisions are at stake. And this is a time where I think I personally have to support hoping that Democrats will do whatever they can to redraw districts and states so that we can combat this, because I don't see that we have any other choice at this point in time, knowing full well that it's not an ideal situation. It's not a completely fair situation. But there are lots of things within our democracy and even in our Constitution that still just aren't fair that we need to continue to work on. To Mayor Sheehan's point, that the Supreme Court, in their last ruling on gerrymandering, essentially gave states permission to do this. And so the Supreme Court is part of our Constitution. They have made the decision that it's okay for states to do this. So states are doing it. And the only way to fix this is to get – the only way to really fix it would be to get Democrats elected to all houses, the Senate and the House, and to the presidential office, and then have them pass some type of new law that would change how we draw districts. But the idea of doing that seems really far-fetched at this point. I will say this. I hope, if nothing else comes of this, I hope that the American people finally begin to understand how important state government is. Because I know that when I was in state government, one of the things that was just constantly frustrating was how little people knew about it, how little they cared about it, how disconnected they were with it. I haven't seen that's changed much lately. But we're seeing now, as this president begins to really downsize, destroy ultimately what our federal government used to look like, we really are left with just 50 state governments that are really making the majority of the really big decisions that affect our lives every day. And the people that we elect in these states to represent us have an enormous amount of power over our lives. And this redistricting process is pointing to that right now. And I hope it's a wake-up call to those who want to try to defend our democracy and hope they get more involved in state races.
Okay. Yeah, and I think, you know, Terry, you know, to your point, I think that Democrats want us to fight. they want Democrats to show that they're going to punch back. And so being nice about this and talking about how it should be and giving people, you know, making this a truly independent process, I don't think that there's any appetite among Democrats for this. I think that they want California to gerrymander the hell out of their districts, and they'd love to see New York and any other state that can potentially do this before the midterms to do it. And that is why I think we've got to, as Democrats, come up with a message on this. I think we're going to talk about it, but former President Obama came out in favor of doing this, and I think that Democrats want us to fight. And if we don't, I think that we'll have a much more difficult time, notwithstanding the gerrymandering going on, winning hearts and minds in the midterms next year.
And Terry mentioned this, but you still have New York. We won't get this done in time in New York, right? For the midterms.
Well, I mean, the way that the system is set up, it would be difficult to do that, but I would never say never. I mean, this president has done things that we never thought could be done, and they're happening, and the courts are not stepping in. And so I wouldn't rule anything out, and I'm sure that the governor and the leaders of our Senate and Assembly are talking about this. I hope they're talking about it right now.
I think it's
I think that I'm sorry. I think the governor Hochul is going to take action on this, and I think all the governors in Democratic states are gonna push the legal limits, just as President Trump has pushed the legal limits on this to go as far as they possibly can to see what they can get away with, because that's the only way we're gonna win this fight. It's just gonna have to be fire with fire.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's really sad and unfortunate that Trump has essentially forced, you know, people into this situation of sort of skewing democracy in the exact same way that he is. But honestly, it's been a long time coming. I wish it had happened sooner. My favorite TikTok for a while has been a guy saying, like, Democrats, whenever Trump passes a new version of the You Will All Suffer Act, and they're like, newsflash. That's unconstitutional. And, you know, they start waving. And it's just, that's what they've been doing, in my opinion, for a while. They're like, well, wait a minute, he can't do that. And he can. He's laid bare the very flimsy foundations on which the country is built. The Supreme Court and all these branches are just, if someone has the drive like Trump does right now, he can, you know, destroy it, essentially.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. Got a good one going. We welcome your letters. We welcome your thoughts. Panel at WAMC.org. All you have to do is write to us, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to hear from you. We will continue the conversation in Studio A after a few messages and this newscast from the BBC. Well, good morning, friends. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning on this 21st day of August. It is 9:33, and we are talking about redistricting. One of the things that Mayor Sheehan brought up, which was a story that I wanted to touch on, of course, we were talking about Texas, but we did also mention California and what is going on in California. What also is happening there is the former president of the United States, Barack Obama, came out yesterday and is supporting redistricting, saying the GOP can't, quote, rig the game. The former president said that what Texas Republicans are doing requires an equally aggressive response from Democrats, which is much of what we've been talking about so far this morning. Texas's proposed map could create at least five additional Republican safe districts, and California's push, framed as something akin to a trigger law, would create a similar number of additional Democratic-leaning districts as a countermeasure as the parties battle for control of the narrowly divided House next year. Obama said that what Texas Republicans are doing requires an equally aggressive response from Democrats. But in the long term, the former president told those gathered at the National Democratic Redistricting Committee fundraiser, there should be no political gerrymandering in America. So how do you do that, Mayor Sheehan?
Well, I don't know that we've ever had that. And I think, you know, when districts are drawn, there are a number of factors that are taken into consideration. But I think that the underlying message of we have to fight back is what Democrats need to be focused on. When we talk about these ideals and when we talk about how things should be, I do think that people are losing their patience. They want to see action and they want us to fight for our democracy. They want us to fight for government that actually is focused on solving the challenges and the problems that we are facing. And I look at what the Republicans are doing in Texas, and it says a lot that the first thing they did when the Democrats came back was take this up, as opposed to starting with the legislation that they are working on to respond to the horrific flooding and the devastation that occurred in Texas. And that's part of the reasons that the Democrats came back. It was indefensible that they weren't there to be able to take action to help those areas that have been ravaged by the floods. But the Republicans are telling us what their values are by saying, we're going to do this first, and then we'll get to the flood relief. And I understand why, right? Because if they did the flood stuff first, the Democrats would just walk out. I get it. But that's where we are. And we are a hyper-partisan, in a hyper-partisan place in this country. And unless Democrats respond accordingly, we are going to be in the minority for, I think, a very, very long time.
Yeah. And also, I mean, Obama's sort of, you know, no more of this. You know, this is the last time. You know, that kind of reminds me of how we got into this whole mess in the first place, which is because, you know, we were essentially just told, well, don't have political parties. So, you know, that's not accounted for in our Constitution, which is why we don't have, you know, a system where we can have a third party or anything like that, because we just automatically fall into these two very partisan, you know, sort of points of view. It's very kind of sad to hear that from him, just very naive almost. I'm not really sure what he was going for there. I think maybe a stronger word would say we can't let the executive branch push us into this situation, which is what's been happening. And we need to have more checks and balances in place to ensure that it doesn't. But right now, we can't worry about all that. We don't have the luxury of trying to be right. Fair in an unfair world.
And fighting the fire with fire. Terry.
I think one of my concerns is that the Democratic Party is relying on a former president who is, to this new generation of voters coming up, really not that well known and whose credibility is in question. It points to a weakness in the party, and that we still don't really have that spokesperson, that face, that personality, that dynamic personality that can really compete with Donald Trump and really excite voters, really get voters to pay attention and get them engaged. We need to find that person desperately, urgently, now. We need that person to step forward. Maybe it's multiple people. There are people that are trying to do this. It's not that we don't have people trying, but we're missing that. And what we are also missing, or what we have been missing for decades now, is a Democratic president, when we did have one, that got as involved in state politics as Donald Trump has gotten involved. Donald Trump has seen the power that exists in state legislatures. He's gotten involved. He has used his powers, his leverage, to get them to do things for him. That's what's happening now. We haven't really seen a Democratic president take that kind of power in the past. And it's one of the reasons the Democratic Party is now weaker than it should be. They haven't gotten as involved in state races as they should have. And it's all coming back now to really bite Democrats. And a lot of weaknesses are being shown because of this. So this is not the time to think about what is necessarily right and wrong. It's the time to think about what needs to be done to save this democracy. And that's going to require a different mindset and a different form of aggression and a different form of, being assertive than Democrats have had in the past. You know, there was a time not that long ago during Biden's first term where we had the House of Representatives, we had the Senate, we had all the power we needed to put so many rules and regulations in place to really stop any of what we're experiencing now from happening, and we didn't do it. There were so many of us that were really pushing them to take aggressive action and pass new laws, to attack the Supreme Court, to take radical steps like that. And we could have done it. We didn't do any of it. And here we are now just wide open with very few defense mechanisms. And the only thing we really have is the people. We have the people that can rise up and put a stop to this. And hopefully we'll see that happen.
I think one big problem with the Democratic Party is just that it's not very cohesive. It's very fractured. There are huge, you know, striations between, you know, the younger members of the party and the older. There are a lot of differing opinions. Some people might think, oh, Bernie Sanders or maybe, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez could be that, you know, spokesperson. But there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who would really oppose that. And I think that's the issue. It's the lack of cohesion. I mean, Trump was, you know, sort of a uniting factor. He got all of these talking points that really united Republicans, and unfortunately the Democrats are just too fractured right now. They've never, I mean, that was where Hillary sort of faltered. She never really got the youth vote. I think that that's sort of a weak spot of the Democratic Party as a whole. I think that that's where a lot of that weakness comes from.
Yeah, I certainly think that we're struggling on the national level to find that authentic person. I mean, say what you want about Donald Trump. He is authentic and he's unapologetic, and he has been able to coalesce people to do things that we all thought no one would ever do, that at some point people who love this country and love our democracy would say that's a bridge too far. And that hasn't happened. But I think that the other thing that we need to start talking about is taking the ref out of the game, right? So, you know, I think that we've got to recognize that this is happening in Texas, and then what are the Democrats going to do about it? We should fight for every single one of those seats. I mean, it, you know, we can't just throw up our hands and say, oh, gerrymandering, it's impossible, because, you know, we now are facing a new reality. And I think that what I hope Democrats in Texas are doing is, you know, looking at who they're going to run for these congressional seats in these new districts. And we should fight like hell to win the hearts and minds of the voters and win those seats. And so that probably sounds hopelessly naive. I'm not in Texas. I don't know all of the dynamics of that. But this is the reality that we're facing. And I think that we should be focusing on what do we have to do to win back the Congress, no matter what the Republicans try to throw at that. And I do think that there is a desire among young people, a desire among Democratic voters across the spectrum to just say, okay, let's fight for these. Let's get this done. What do we have to do? And how do we mobilize to win these seats?
And obviously, they're saying the same thing, I assume, in California.
I would hope.
To Republicans taking over, right? I mean, to fight for those districts as well.
And sure. I think that they're better at that. I think that they're better at propping up their you know, new people.
Terry?
I was just going to say, one of the things we should be prepared for, it'll happen any day now, is that when Democrats do take action on this and they do redraw the lines and they're successful at doing it, you're going to immediately see Donald Trump accuse Democrats of being corrupt, that, you know, these are illegal lines. They're not real. Therefore, the election is rigged. But when Republicans do it, Donald Trump is going to say, you know, it's justice. It's correct. It's right. We're going to see that happen. We have to be prepared for that, not let it stop us. And we have to be prepared for this to get ugly. I think it has potential to get really, really ugly, both in the courts and in the streets, because our democracy is always hinged on the American people accepting really the decisions of courts, accepting the decisions of elections. We are getting really close to a point where we may see certain segments of the population no longer be accepting of that, and therefore taking action in the street that we don't typically see here in this country. And it could become very disruptive to our daily lives and even to our economy. And I think we have to be prepared for that, because it's getting really close to it.
Not to be bratty, but is this really the issue that's going to bring people to the streets?
I would hope. I mean, it's gotten so bad already. I mean, it's just this constant stream of, is this the issue? Probably not. It's probably going to happen after the elections, when things actually start happening, when all of these,
right,
when the big, beautiful bill actually comes into effect. I hate that I called it that, the big, ugly bill.
All right, let's take a break. We have a lot of letters. We'll get to those on the other side. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 21st day of August. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We have letters from members of our listening audience. We welcome you to add your letter to the mailbox. And here we go. Mike says, while this partisan arms race of gerrymandering slash redistricting sucks and is bad, I gotta say it really is unimaginative to simply engage in these terms. What if the Democratic Party attempted to convince more people to vote for them by articulating a novel platform of decommodifying critical things like healthcare and utilities and higher education, restoring our public institutions, and launching a transformative project of building and building out a nationwide green economy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that was the point I was trying to make, is we've got to win. We've got to win hearts and minds. And we can talk about this and wring our hands, but we know what the playing field looks like. We know that it's rigged, and we still can win, but we've got to be able to have leadership that is speaking to and responsive of the very issues that that were articulated there.
We go do.
We
go
have
ahead,
to do both.
Terry.
We have to do both. We have to do what we can to get these lines redrawn, and we have to get the message out through campaigns that resonate with people, especially those people that don't normally vote or those that don't normally vote for Democrats. We got to do both, because the data that is used to redraw these maps is very accurate. And it's based on human nature. Human nature is predictable. People have habits. It's hard for them to break those habits. And so when these lines are redrawn, they are done in such a way where it is pretty set that the party drawing the lines is going to have a really, really good chance of winning no matter what the other party does. But it can be beaten. It can fail. But it does require that messaging. So you have to do both.
The very Larry David, pretty. I like that. Emily?
I was just saying that I think it's a lot of fear. It's a lot of fear of retribution. I mean, they don't want to take that step. They don't want to say something that might, you know, go over poorly with their established base, which is something that the, you know, Trump and the Republicans are very, very willing to do. I mean, they're very willing to just, you know, lie and say that it will do things that it won't. They're willing to very confidently say things and try to, you know, strong arm people onto their side. Democrats simply aren't willing to do that. And of course, they don't have the cohesive views that they need. They are infighting with each other about, you know, some of these ideas proposed in the email. So it would be lovely if they could do that, but it's easier said than done.
Alice writes to us and says, aren't the Republicans in a hurry? That's why they're doing it now. But this is what they would do in a few years anyway. I mean, this is a tit-for-tat situation, whereas the 10-year custom is not, because no one monitors each state's process. Finally, it is just a custom, or is it the Constitution that the redistrictings happen only every 10 years? A question from Alice. And the census getting in there, of course. All right. Go to Steve. The proportion of New York Democrats in the House is greater than the proportion of New Yorkers who are registered Democrats. Do the panelists consider New York's districts to be gerrymandered? I'll give that one to you, Terry. You were there while the sausage was being made.
I think at this point in our nation's current history, I feel really confident in saying that every congressional district in every state is gerrymandered. I think that's just the way it is. It's the system. The system encourages it. The system allows it. And so, yes, they are.
Mayor?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are these ideals, right, of keeping places together that have, the idea behind the district is that you've got common interests. So I know when the redistricting was happening in New York, the mayors of Schenectady and Troy and Albany and Amsterdam and Saratoga talked about how the things that we do together, right, and how they're having the same representative in Washington we felt was beneficial. But again, I think that when you look at some of these districts, you know, to Terry's point, they only make sense through the eyes of, you know, blue and red.
I would also add in just another perspective, which is, you know, yes, it is gerrymandering. It is, they are all gerrymandered. I think we all know that. But on the other hand, I don't think that at this point in history, we've had the luxury of trying to be fair about this when the platforms that the Republicans are running on are just so heinous. I mean, I looked up all the platforms that some of the Republicans, Texas Republicans mentioned in the article were running on. And I'm thinking, you know, if we can do anything to get those people out of power, then we should do it. I'm sorry. I know it's not fair. I know it's not how it's quote unquote supposed to be. But this also isn't how politics is supposed to be in general. You're not supposed to be, you know, just electing people who have no idea what they're doing to office. But that's unfortunately what seems to be happening in Texas.
I just want to go back to the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court is a legal part of our Constitution. They are set up to have the final word as to what is legal and not legal in this country. And their last ruling on gerrymandering essentially said that gerrymandering is okay, with some exceptions, that being race-based gerrymandering. But otherwise, it's okay. So this idea of it being fair or not fair, according to the Supreme Court, it's not only fair, but it's legal. So let's do it.
Marianne says, can you stop creating fantasies? Democrats never had the power for radical action when we had the majority because of the filibuster, which Manchin and Sinema would not allow us to get rid of. Trump is not authentic. He is the opposite. Republicans are not unified. They are terrified of Trump and afraid to dissent or even do their jobs. Anyone who has stood up to him in the past has been purged. That is from Marion.
I mean, you're still unified in your terror of Trump and your lack of a drive to stand up to anyone. That counts as being unified. Might not be under a great cause, but
still counts. John says, what the Democrats need to do is counter Trump's rhetoric against him when they fight the Republicans back with their own redistricting tactics is this, quote, we're willing to stop the redistricting arms race. That's why the Democratic Party and its candidates promised to pass a national law against gerrymandering and a national nonpartisan panel to draw all districts. Our opponents refuse to do so. Of course, the Democrats are excellent at snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. So, .. says John.
Yeah.
But I do think that we're talking about the wrong thing. I think that when you start to talk about how districts are drawn and gerrymandering and the data and all of the work that goes into it, people have already stopped listening to you. They want us to be talking about what we are going to do and how we are going to lead and how we're going to fight what people see happening in Washington and the things that they the very reasons that they oppose the Trump administration. Right. I think that's what we've got to be talking about. And I feel like at this point in time, too many Democrats are just tiptoeing around it because I don't know why. I think that the fear of alienating part of the party, you know, some of the things, you know, that the points that Emily made. And, you know, so when I say that Trump is authentic, what I mean is, like, he doesn't care.
Yeah.
He will say what he thinks no matter what. And, you know, he just puts it out there. And I think that we're looking for that person who's just going to be themselves and who's going to say, this is what I'm going to fight for. And this is what I believe in. And this is where Democrats need to go.
Yeah, Trump flouts social conventions. You know, he's not afraid. It's like, oh, you can't say that. And of course, what he's saying is like horrifically racist and sexist. Oh, slavery wasn't that bad, or whatever the latest thing he said was. And that shows people that he's authentic. You know, he quote unquote tells it like it is, and he's saying it in a very horrible, horrible way. But they don't care. They just care that he's supposedly not part of the establishment. He's not playing by their rules.
Carolyn writes, there is no mainstream coverage of this, but there are people in the streets. L.A. and Portland and other cities have had ongoing protests for months. There are now protesters in D.C. as well. Well, that is the case. Certainly that is the case. But I think talking about some national efforts and ultimately, Terry, and you can disagree with me on this, but also because you touched on it, that's why I'm pointing it in your direction, but the leadership that goes with that, right, of someone to stand up and to be a leader of that resistance movement.
Yeah, well, we I'm not sure who that is right now.
Right.
You know, the
and that's the problem.
the chaos that I was envisioning it would be once Democrats are successful at redrawing their maps. And once Democrats win back a majority of seats in the House because of those maps, and when Democrats then begin to assert the new power they have, that's when I predict that you would see some chaos in the streets, because there would be those followers of Donald Trump that would not accept the elections, that would not accept the results. They would say those lines were drawn illegally, therefore the power the Congress has is not real. And that you would begin to see real dangerous protests in the street. That's what I was looking at down the road, not immediately. And I do agree that Democrats are not going to win any votes by talking about redistricting one way or the other. That's not what they should be talking about. They should just do it and talk to the voters about what they're going to do with the new power they're given. That's how they're going to get elected. And I'm not sure I actually answered the questions you asked me, but that's what I got.
No, I think you did. Absolutely.
Okay. Well,
I'm going to give you credit for answering those questions.
And to the point about, yes, there are protests going on. And, you know, I keep stealing your stories, Joe. But according to Pete Hegseth and the vice president, they're actually a bunch of old white hippies who need to go home and take a nap. speaking of the people who were heckling them at Union Station in D.C. over the occupation of Washington and the National Guard being there. So.
Well, we also got this letter from Kevin who says, dear panel, where is Jack Kennedy when we need him? Well, we could tell you where he is, but it's kind of a bummer of a story. So we'll just kind of, you know, you can look it up. Google that one. Also, this one from Elizabeth. Have you heard of the independent redistricting commissions in states like Michigan and Colorado? Not every state is gerrymandered.
Yeah, well, I would ask those two who are really interested in this to really drill down into the details of what independent redistricting looks like, because it sounds good, but in many states, including New York, once you really drill down deep, there's always a little bitty sliver of a gap where politicians can get their foothold in and find ways to still control how the maps are drawn, even though it's titled independent. So I think you have to be really careful about how you judge that.
We'll take a break and be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our second hour. I thank you very much for being with us. Preceptor in public speaking, strategic communications, and public relations for the Faculty of Arts and Sciences at Harvard University, Terry Gibson is with us. Grants analyst Emily Honan is here, and mayor of the city of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. We welcome them all and thank them for being present as we continue our conversation this morning. New topic up for bids. President Trump's Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller said on Wednesday that the administration planned to add, quote, thousands more resources to its crackdown on crime underway in Washington, D.C. Mr. Miller said this while standing at a burger restaurant inside a train station in the middle of the afternoon. He was with Vice President J.D. Vance and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth. The three decided to drop by the Shake Shack in Union Station, like you do, so they could buy burgers for and take pictures with some of the National Guard troops who are patrolling the train hall as part of the administration's crackdown. But as the trio of top Trump officials walked through the cavernous train hall, they were heckled and booed by people in transit. Inside the Shake Shack, Mr. Miller declared that the jeering would directly result in the administration throwing more resources at lowering crime rates that Mr. Trump has called totally out of control, but that have actually fallen sharply the past 2 years. "I'm glad they're here today," Mr. Miller said of the hecklers, "because me, Pete, and the vice president are all going to leave here, and inspired by them, we're going to add thousands more resources to this city to get the criminals and the gang members out of here." That said by the deputy chief of staff at a Shake Shack.
You know, no offense to Terry here, I really just don't think we should have men in positions of power. I mean, they're just too emotional.
Yeah, this is very...
I mean, look at that. I mean, look how their emotions can just fluctuate. I mean, you know, you can't really count on that.
No, just to retaliate so quickly over something, you know, you see something and you just immediately react.
They're like those nervous little dogs.
Yeah.
Yeah. I close my eyes. I'm sorry. I said I closed my eyes and visualized a really angry fifth grader on the playground.
That's what they are.
Terry, what do you think?
Well, I was going to say, and look how they dress. This picture in the Washington Post of Pete Hegseth. He's got on this plaid suit, this blue plaid suit. It looks like he's, you know, auditioning for like a clown position. It's embarrassing, really. It's, you know, I have to agree at this point. I mean, you know, are men really qualified for this position? I'm beginning to really doubt that. This is a joke. I mean, there's so many things that should upset the American people that this presidential administration has done. But this one is just ridiculous. They're at a Shake Shack Shake Shack, ordering burgers while the country is engaged in a massive housing crisis, a healthcare system that's in shambles, environmental crises all around the state, poverty in so many areas across this country. There are real problems in this country. People are suffering in this country. And we have an administration that's dumping millions and millions of dollars into a situation that is non-existent. The crime in this particular part of the country, D.C., is going down while it's going up in other parts of the country that are being ignored. You can send as many National Guard troops as you want to Washington, D.C. You can flood the place for all I care. But it's not going to change a thing about the problems that this country is facing that this administration is completely ignoring.
Well, and Terry, I think taking that a step further, in the article it was reported that one of this trio talked about the fact that crime in black neighborhoods was the problem that they were solving, and that they described these protesters as white hippies who are out of touch, and these guys are the ones that are going to deal with crime in predominantly black neighborhoods. And as a mayor,
yeah,
I agree. Crime in our formerly redlined neighborhoods, crime in places where we have concentrated poverty, is a real issue. And people deserve to be safe, no matter where they live and what their income level is. And addressing that and really understanding the drivers of crime and the connection between the very challenges that you're talking about, lack of access to education, lack of access to jobs, lack of access to good housing, lack of access to good health care. Those are all drivers that if we address those issues, and we've demonstrated that when you address those issues, you see crime come down. And so they're just playing at this, I think, to your point about how they're dressed. They are acting in a show. They are not leading this country.
I think what really gets me about that, too, is that, you know, Trump tries to put off this whole image that we were talking about earlier, like, oh, he's not one of the establishment. This is like the most establishment thing they could possibly do. This is right up there with like kissing a baby. It's so transparent, and they're not even, you know, trying to pretend it's anything other than, you know, some kind of arms race. You know, they're just like, oh, you know, you guys were mean to me? Well, I'm in charge. I've got all the money. I'm going to send more guys out here because I can do that. It is very embarrassing. And I mean, this is coming from Pete Hegseth, who had a scandal that would have, you know, devastated the Democratic Party if it had happened to them. You know, and now it's just, you know, last month's news, the whole Signal thing. They are very embarrassing. That's what I've been saying from the beginning. It's an embarrassment, truly.
Also, the idea of being at Union Station, where by all accounts the problems really are not what problems there are not there, and I think that also seems to be misdirected.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I did a summer internship in Washington D.C. in 1985. Yes, I am very old. And you couldn't walk through Union Station. I mean, you talk about unsafe. It was a scary place. It was a very scary place. And then was obviously transformed and revitalized. And, you know, the challenges that they are seeing in Washington, D.C. are similar to challenges that you're seeing all over, is that when you don't have everybody coming into work, then places are less crowded. And you have less eyes and people feel less safe. You know, that's not hard to solve. I shouldn't say that. You don't solve that with the National Guard. There are other ways to be looking at those issues and reimagining those places and spaces.
So in my naivete, let me ask this question. When you see what you're seeing of booing in Union Station and certain Republican representatives being booed off the stage at various platforms by both Democrats and Republicans, it does give you a sense, and maybe it's true, maybe it's not, I don't know, but it could give you a sense that there is a shift happening.
I mean, that all depends on who they come up with to run against these people. I mean, part of the reason they're able to do this and they don't care is because they know, you know, their job isn't in danger. You know, if they get redistricted, whatever, there's not going to be any viable replacement for them. So they aren't worried. And we need the Democratic Party, or not even the Democratic Party, just someone somewhere to take advantage of that, which is difficult to do. It's hard to be just like a grassroots politician these days. It's not something that can happen in 3 months, but it's looking like that's what we need.
Terry?
It is one of the downsides, one of the dangers of redistricting that we've been talking about, and that it creates seats where it's extremely difficult to get someone of the other party elected, and therefore you end up with a country that is created predominantly out of congressional seats that are considered safe, meaning that you rarely have an opponent, or you rarely have an opponent that can actually win, no matter how hard they try. And so voters begin to recognize that, they get lazy, they kind of give up, they become disengaged. And without a dynamic leader stepping forward with a new message that resonates with those particular people that have kind of just disengaged, we just kind of have the status quo, and people like these three clowns are able to show up at a Shake Shack and put on these kinds of ridiculous shows, and the American people just kind of accept it as the way things are. And if that's where we're headed, then that's a scary place.
Mayor?
I certainly think that there are those of us who are eternal optimists who see these actions and the response, but it really is going to be determined in the midterm elections. Who shows up, who turns out, and who either flips their vote, they voted Republican and they're going to vote for a Democrat, or getting Democrats out in bigger numbers and enthusiastically behind candidates. And look, I think, you know, my hypothesis is that part of the reason that we're not seeing that dynamism, people willing to come out and say things that I think people are very hungry to hear, is because our politics are driven by mostly corporate money now.
Yeah.
Very wealthy donors and corporate money. And the Democrats need to raise money just as much as the Republicans need to raise money. And I think when you see the reaction to Mamdani winning the primary in New York City, you are seeing this divide in the Democratic Party play itself out. And I know New York City is a very different place, but I think that that's what we're seeing. And so I think some are being quiet because they want to be able to continue to raise money from corporate donors and they're a very wealthy base. And again, that's another problem that we have with our democracy, thanks to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to other stories. And what else is going on? I was struck that, as you were mentioning the Mamdani race, that Andrew Cuomo was hoping that Trump will help him beat Mamdani. And I know there's that old adage in politics of politics makes strange bedfellows, but good God. Wait.
Well, you never know what Trump is going to do, to be fair. I mean, he's, you know, they have that rule in the White House where it's like, we make sure he says something twice. And if he says something twice, we'll do it.
Yes. Andrew Cuomo told donors at a private fundraiser in the Hamptons that he believed President Trump would wade into the race for New York City mayor and help clear a path for his election. Cuomo, who is running as an independent in the general election after losing June's Democratic primary, made the comments on Saturday as he sought to convince Trump-friendly donors that he was best positioned in the crowded field of candidates to defeat Assemblyman Zohran Mamdani, his party's leftist nominee. Mr. Cuomo predicted, without citing any evidence, that Mayor Eric Adams, another Democrat running as an independent, would bow out of the contest at the end of the day rather than be a spoiler. Terry?
I just don't see it. I don't see what Donald Trump can say or do that's going to change the outcome of Mamdani ultimately being the new mayor of New York City. I've kind of looked at all the different scenarios, and I kind of think it could all backfire on Donald Trump. Anything that he says is likely just to galvanize more support for Mamdani. And I think that Andrew Cuomo is fighting a losing battle. I mean, we'll see. I could be wrong, but I just don't see the path to victory for him.
You wonder, in the Cuomo world, of someone who has been, an enemy, is you look to that person and in New York City, especially after the shellacking that Cuomo took in the primary, of what he would hope for and get when it comes to help from Donald Trump.
Well, the voters are hungry. You know, the voters are hungry for something new, and this is what Mamdani has tapped into. And it's what we need more people to do across the country in the Democratic Party. The old names like Cuomo and Kennedy and Schumer, all these other big names that Pelosi that we're so used to over the last decades, the young voters don't recognize these names anymore. They don't really carry any credibility with them anymore. They look around at the world they're inheriting, and they look to those people as old and outdated and out of touch. And I think Mamdani, in my opinion, is a sign of optimism for the Democratic Party. It's of a new voice, of a new dawn, and it to me it's exciting. So I'm watching it closely, and I hope he wins.
I agree with that. And I also agree that it's not that the names are not recognized. I think that they now carry a bad connotation. You know, I think that a lot of, you know, top Democratic politicians are seen as laughingstocks for young people. I mean, they're the butt of many jokes about how you know, they just don't seem to do anything, which is not, you know, in an unfair assessment, especially when we were just talking about how we had the chance during Biden's term to do something and just did not. So people are very young people are very frustrated. And if young people are able to show up to the polls, that can make a difference. Although, of course, we know that Trump is already trying to tamp down on that by trying to end mail-in voting.
Yeah, and I think that this generational divide, when you think about the baby boom generation and how large it is, that it's not surprising that it's taking so long for new leadership to be able to rise up and break through that. But I do think that the Democrats need to self-reflect on that and see that we have to listen to that next generation of leaders. You know, I see it in mayors. I see it in young mayors that are getting elected across the country. And they are ready. They are ready to lead. They are ready to I think, capture that younger people and reinvigorate and get them involved. And that's exactly what Mamdani did. And so we've got to, again, I think, lean into that. You know, one of the reasons that I decided not to run for a fourth term is, first of all, I think it's ludicrous to have four terms, but I wanted to see the next generation of leaders lead this city. That's what the future is. And I think, you know, some of those names that you rattled off there, there are people that I admire. I truly admire Nancy Pelosi, and she should be studied, and she should be an inspiration to young people. And those young people who are inspired by her are ready to lead, and we need to let them lead.
Yeah. But you can stay at the party too long.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go to another topic, and we begin. We don't begin. We continue. That's the word I was looking for. Let's see. We only have 5 minutes, but we'll start the story and probably continue it on the other side of the break. But we welcome you to certainly get your letters in during the break. The Trump administration says that the Smithsonian is fixated on slavery, especially at the African-American Museum, about the black experience, that it is focused on slavery. And so President Trump is threatening to unleash his attorneys on the Smithsonian, which he called out of control, accused them of dwelling too much on slavery, have sharpened concerns about what he has planned for an institution already subject to sweeping White House review. In a post-truth social message, Trump said the Smithsonian Institution focused too much on how bad slavery was and called museums essentially the last remaining segment of woke. The White House last week announced a more aggressive review of the Smithsonian's content, starting with 8 museums. Trump offered slightly more detail in Tuesday's post, saying he had instructed many attorneys to go through the museums and start the exact same process that has been done with colleges and universities, where tremendous progress has been made, in the president's opinion. The Smithsonian, he wrote, is out of control, shouty caps, where everything discussed is how horrible our country is, how bad slavery was, and how unaccomplished the downtrodden have been. Nothing about success, nothing about brightness, nothing about the future, Trump's post said. A White House official did not offer more detail on the attorney's review, but told the Washington Post that President Trump will explore all options and avenues to get the woke out of the Smithsonian and hold them accountable. A spokesperson for the Smithsonian declined to comment on the president's remarks.
I hate him so much.
Oh, Jesus. I understand. Yeah.
Or are we taking a break first?
No, go ahead.
It is always a good sign when an authoritarian member of the executive branch starts tamping down on history and colleges and museums. Definitely always a good sign. Never a sign of horrible things to come in, you know, erasing history and trying to deny that these things happened, which he's absolutely doing. You know, let's not get it wrong. He's not just saying we're focusing too much on the bad. He's trying to eliminate the talking about the bad at all and pretend it didn't happen. When this country was built on slavery, it's very obvious that that's what happened. He might not know that. I know he probably didn't really pay attention in his classes, but it's very true. And he is himself trying to rewrite history. And I wish that he would almost be a little bit more, you know, outspoken about that. I wish he would just come out and say, I am rewriting history, because that's what he's trying to do.
Nothing about success, nothing about brightness, nothing about the future. You look at several periods in this country where it just seems to me, for most people, it would be difficult to see those attributes.
Well, yeah. I mean, when you have a country that is founded on white supremacy and patriarchy, yeah. It's really hard for those of us who, were invited to the table much later to be able to fathom how we now have a president who wants to turn back time. And but that's what we have, and that's who was elected, and people knew it.
Terry. Well, actually, Terry, hold. Let's take a break. We'll be right back. Right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Our last segment together on the panel this morning on this 21st day of August. Terry Gibson, Emily Honan, and Kathy Sheehan, the mayor of Albany, with us on this morning. We have been talking about the President of the United States saying that the Smithsonian Institution fixates on slavery, and scholars say they are sanitizing history. The latest, the White House, in their order on the Smithsonian, said that they are scrutinizing, quote, improper ideology there at the Smithsonian. Terry Gibson.
Well, the truth is that for the most of our country's history, we have sanitized slavery through the textbooks, through the museums, through whoever was telling the story. It's really only been in the last, maybe like 20, 25 years that we have really began to come to terms with the reality of the horrors of that institution and begin to recognize that even today we are still living with the impact that has had on generation after generation of people that have never really had the opportunities that so many others have. And it's terrifying to me, it is, that we have a president who is doing everything they can to try to change the narrative about slavery and about just the history of our country in general. And you're seeing him make progress in it just by being able to get out and say it in public on his public social media platforms begins the process of changing the narrative, because people will see that, they will hear it, they will repeat it. And he's having success at trying to really make America white again, which is, we know is what this campaign has always been about. And they would have made more progress on this in his first term had Democrats not had the power then that they don't have now. You're seeing it in colleges. You're seeing it in libraries. You're seeing it now in our nation's museums. And American people are going to have to stand up and fight back against this, because if we do not, then we will revert back to 1940, 1950, and our history will be whitewashed once again, and we just can't stand for it.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of people want that. A lot of people, idolize the 50s, and people like Trump, I'm sure, would idolize the 50s, not understanding or caring about how horrible the 50s were for everybody who wasn't a white man, a white, straight Christian man. But when you've been on a pedestal your entire life, equality seems like oppression. And I mean, as Terry was saying, we have only really started scratching the surface of just how bad, just how intrinsic to our history this, you know, oppression and badness was over the past 20 years. And all of a sudden, people are thinking that this is horribly unfair, that everything is wokeified, that, you know, it's going to push the upper class out. It's very transparent. It's very worrying. And it's just, it's very sad to see.
Yeah. And it's very much, you know, Trump does this, you know, every once in a while, right? He has to throw something out to his white supremacist base, and give them, you know, something that the dog whistles, that he doles out. And I think that, you know, the piece of this that is so disturbing, right, is that in addition to being racist and horrific, is that they do really mean when they say they want a meritocracy, they want a meritocracy for straight white Christian men. And if you are a straight white Christian man, you are qualified, period, full stop. It does not matter what you've done, whether you're competent. We see that in his administration. And so for those who are pushing back, though, interestingly, and, you know, maybe he's setting himself up for a national run, but the Republican mayor of Oklahoma City published an op-ed in the New York Times yesterday where he said, "I'm a lifelong Republican who believes in meritocracy, but meritocracy cannot be exclusionary. Every person," and he's talking about the conference room wall, much like in the city hall, we have a conference room with a picture of every mayor. "Every person depicted on the conference room wall was a qualified and well-intentioned public servant, but there were women, people of color, and leaders from other parts of the city who could have also been competent mayors. Heavy layers of history, exclusion, bigotry, and glass ceilings stood in their way." And I think that, you know, when you look at the messaging and this threat of taking over these institutions that we value, that are imperfect, but that we value as independent, is a path that we all know how that story has ended when it has happened in the past.
I also wanted to bring something up, and yes, this is going to be kind of like a foil to maybe what my dad, Rich Honan, would say. And I think a lot of people, towards the end of the article, there was a quote from a podcaster who said something about, oh, it's just about how white people are all bad. And I think that that's the sort of rhetoric that Trump wants to push, that they're saying, oh, all white people are bad, when that's not what it is. Privilege just refers to the fact that your skin color has not been a deterrent to you getting where you are. And that's the same for male privilege, for straight privilege. It has not been a deterrent. It's not that you personally are more or less qualified for any one position. It's just that you don't even see the kinds of barriers that exist to other people who don't have the kind of privilege that you have. We're not trying to say all white people are bad, all white straight Christian men are bad. We're not saying that you personally are bad. We're just saying that there are barriers that you do not face, that we face, that you need to understand.
I think we have time for one more topic as we wrap up on this morning. For this morning, and something near and dear to my heart. So before we do that, let me get to some of the letters. Does anybody know if there is a dictatorship watch where the authoritarian actions that Trump has taken so far are cataloged, shown on a timeline, and how it compares with what Orban in Hungary has done and what happened in Germany in the 30s, and similar trajectories in other times and countries, so we can compare and contrast to see the specifics. Sort of a holistic way to look at all of the topics being discussed today and up till now regarding Trump 2.0. Thank you for that. We go to this letter from Paul. Brandt, who says, for African Americans, slavery is basically their origin story. It's how and why they are here. We're all immigrants to this country, but our ancestors came willingly. Theirs did not. So it is a big deal. We should all learn about it. That from Brandt. We go to DJ. What gaslighting by our sinister president? I've only been in the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum a couple of times, but it seemed to me it was only about good success stories, such as how we basically conquered against overwhelming odds, the daunting challenges of space, and put humans on the moon. I suspect there are just maybe a good success story or two or thousands in those hallowed halls. Well, yes.
Certainly. I mean, I've never walked through a Smithsonian and not learned something new and things that I'm very proud of, and people who did amazing things during really difficult and incredible times. So should be on everyone's list to take a trip to D.C. and visit.
And maybe do it quickly.
Yeah.
Paul says, does anyone know if they're... second time I got messed up on that. I said it before, I said it again, said Ray. Trump is infuriated that he is on the impeachment section. History is history, and no matter how hard you try, you can't erase it. There is a section within the Smithsonian that talks about impeachment of presidents of the United States, and Trump's name, of course, is mentioned in there, as he was impeached twice while in office in his first term. So
he's trying to get it off, isn't he?
Yes. Well, they took it out, and then they put it back, and then they sort of downplayed it a little bit more. But I believe right now, as of today, it is in there, sort of. So then we go to Stephen. So Stable Genius wants historical museums to be about the future? Well, I like that. Let's see. We go. I think we have one more. I thought we had one more letter, and maybe we don't. Okay. So let's move on to our final story this morning. And we go to something near and dear to my heart, but it is it's not a great story. I've seen a couple versions of this over the last couple of months, and this is a report that was released, a study that was released this week that talks about why so few Americans read for pleasure. Fewer Americans than ever are reading for pleasure, according to a new study released Wednesday, declining 40% in the last 20 years. Only 16% of Americans age 15 and over read for leisure every day. In 2023, according to a study from researchers at the University of Florida and the University College of London that was published on Wednesday in the journal iScience, compared with 28% of Americans in 2003. The new findings come as Americans' attention spans and print book sales are in decline, and artificial intelligence technology is aiming to summarize knowledge as quickly as possible. While there's evidence the trend began in the 40s, this most recent decline in reading for pleasure is significant, according to Jill Sankey, the co-director of the EpiArts Lab at the University of Florida. The study, which was based on time use data from nearly 240,000 Americans between 2003 and 2023, and excluded 2020 due to the world's COVID pandemic, found that time adults spent reading to children did not drop during that period, but only a small portion of participants, 2%, read to kids every day. as an co-investigator in the study, but also as a mother and grandmother and as a person. The author says, I think how little people are reading with children and to children, which is very concerning, said Sankey in a phone interview. The new research, along with the other recent surveys showing a widening gap when it comes to reading in America, where people with less education are not as likely to read as people with higher education levels. Terry?
Well, I spend most of my time in classrooms with college students, so I can really only speak from that perspective. And I can tell you from that perspective that getting college students in this day and time to read anything that's more than three lines in social media is really challenging, more challenging than it's ever been. It's getting harder every single day, even just getting them to put the phones down to take time to read something that is not on the phone is really challenging. So it's real, and I have to assume that is the same across the board as you go up the age ladder because of the way technology is changing and the way the AI is coming into play and the way the AI can now sort of generate things in ways that really compete with the traditional writings that we're so accustomed to. So big changes. Joe, I have to jump off to deal with something here at home. I apologize. But
we are out of time anyway, Terry, but thank you very much for being there, being here. I appreciate it. Mayor, just about 30 seconds. Anything you want to say on this issue?
Yeah, look, I think I know my attention span is worse because of technology. I look forward to when I'm no longer mayor, not having to have my phone with me 24/7. So that I can work on expanding my attention span. And I love to read, and I do still read, but it's no surprise to me that this is the finding. It's disturbing, but it's not surprising.
Emily?
Yeah, I can feel my attention span eroding. I think a part of it is also because there's just a lot less time in the day for a lot of people. I mean, when I used to commute an hour to work each way, I mean, I would come home, I would have 4 hours to do whatever. And, you know, that's just not enough time for a lot of people to read.
Books on tape at 1.7 speed, you can get a lot in.
I know. That's
okay.
What I did do.
There you go. Thanks all for being with us. I appreciate it to Terry, Emily, and Mayor Sheehan. I appreciate it. We'll be back right after this.